ね、
どうしてもする。
Just one more question here. So, you know, we've been talking about the pizza, but would this go along with any kind of obsessive thought that you're having? Okay. So we should be thinking about where this thought arises, how it is craving, perhaps also, and then.
Look, and first, where's the appeal? There are five questions the Buddha has you ask. One is, can you see it arise? Can you see it pass away? Because in the arising and the passing away, there are going to be other things arising and other things passing away at the same time. Mm-hmm. We're going to watch for that. Secondly, can you see what the allure is? Mm-hmm. When I talk about things that are enduring and alluring in the world, what is it about this set of attraction? Mm-hmm. What do you feel you're getting out of it? And then the fourth one is the drawbacks. And then the fifth question is, how do I get out of this? And a lot of it has to do with seeing the allure, and then seeing through the allure. I know a lot of people, when they say that, you know, I have this problem with anger, I really don't like the anger, but I don't know what to do with it. The first question you've got to ask yourself is, what do I like about the anger? Where do I enjoy it? Is it, you know, the rush of energy? Is it the feeling of power? Is it the, you know, that sense of self-righteousness? Oh, you know, what is it that I find alluring about this? And then you've got to look at the drawbacks. I mean, what kind of allure is that? And it's answering those five questions. That's what insight comes down to. Okay, the noble truth of the path. Okay. Right view here is defined as knowledge in terms of stress, knowledge in terms of the origination of stress, knowledge in terms of the cessation, and knowledge in terms of the path of practice leading to the cessation of stress. You notice that phrase, in terms of. You're looking at this, using this as a framework for looking at your experience. It's not like you just have to memorize, okay, this is stress, this is the cause of stress. You want to look at your experience in terms of this framework, so you can figure out, okay, now I can identify that experience was an experience of stress, this is an experience of the cause. You're taking this as a framework for looking at your experience. This is very different from frameworks we usually use, which are frameworks which are phrased in terms of becoming. Who I am, what my desire is, what is there out in the world that I can do to feed this desire, satisfy that. That's our usual framework. That kind of framework, by the way, the Buddha calls babancha. Probably heard, if you've been on any meditation retreats, you hear about, I've had a babancha attack, a proliferation attack. Mm-hmm. Jean, what do they call it nowadays?
People have used lots of images, but I mean, I think like cauliflower mind, it's just like producing flowers and flowers and flowers of thought.
Okay. The word babancha doesn't actually, it tends to mean, in the Vipassana schools, it tends to mean just lots and lots of thoughts coming attacking all at once. The Buddhist term for it is actually, it's a particular kind of thinking where you're thinking in terms of who I am and then what I want based on what I am. That's babancha. That's the way we normally frame our words, our thoughts and our activities. And the Buddha's asking you instead, okay, let's look at it in different terms. In terms of, okay, what here is stress, what here is causing that stress to arise? Can I see the stress pass, and what do I do in order to help it pass? That's a different set of questions. Okay, this is questions about me and my desire as the basic idea. Okay, what can I do to get my desire? This is a different one. What can I do to comprehend the stress? What can I do to abandon the cause? It has a different set of imperatives. Now, this is one of three levels of right view. There's one level of right view that comes prior to this, and another level of right view that comes after. Okay. The one that comes prior, let me read it to you. It reads kind of funny, but there's a lot of interesting stuff there when you tease it out. It's called mundane right view. This actually looks at things in terms of the world of people. And if this is right view for when you're dealing in the world and getting into the practice yourself. There is what is given, what is offered, what is sacrificed. There are fruits and results of good and bad actions. There is this world and the next world. There is mother and father. There are spontaneously reborn beings. There are contemplatives and Brahmins who, faring rightly and practicing rightly, proclaim this world and the next after having directly known and realized it for themselves. There's a lot there. Basically comes down to the issue of karma and rebirth. Your actions do have consequences, and they do last beyond this lifetime. Not only that, there are people who have practiced to the point where they know that this is true. In a way, it's a statement of faith. It's kind of an operating, your working hypothesis. Because basically, if you didn't believe that your actions were shaping your experience, then there wouldn't be anything you could do about suffering. This is one of the reasons why the Buddha wasn't the sort of person who would go out and pick fights. But there are people that he would go out and argue with. And most of the times you get people coming to visit the Buddha and arguing. But there are a couple of cases when the Buddha goes out and looks for people to argue with. Mm-hmm. And there are people who talk determinism, fatalism, the idea that there's nothing you can do, everything is determined by fate, or everything is determined by some creator God. The Buddha would go and argue with him. Say, look, the idea that you're doing a path of practice makes no sense. If everything is predetermined, why do anything at all? It's just going to happen anyhow. If you're going to have a path of practice, you have to believe that your actions have results. A couple other things here in this definition of mundane right view are a little strange. There is what is given, what is offered, what is sacrificed. Sounds like a kind of statement. What it comes down to is the fact that the Brahmins have been teaching for centuries, or millennia actually, that what is given bears fruit, especially if it's given to Brahmins. You can see where this is going to lead. Mm-hmm. There are people who, after centuries of hearing this, say, wait a minute, we've been fed a line. Mm-hmm. And they say, you know, all these sacrifices and all these offerings, they bear no fruit at all. And the reasoning they gave was one of two. One is either that your actions are predetermined, therefore the act of giving a gift is nothing special virtuous. The fact that you gave food to somebody, that was because you had to give food to somebody, you had no choice in the matter. The other is that, okay, everybody dies in the end anyhow, so what virtue is there being nice to people? Because we're all going to die and that's it. And when the Buddha is saying there is something that is given, he's basically saying no to both of those ideas. On one hand, your actions, you really do choose your actions, so the act of choice of having done something good is a virtuous choice. And secondly, life does go beyond, or, you know, consciousness does go beyond death, and so it's worthwhile to be good to one another, because it's going to bear fruit in the long term. He also says there is mother and father. That means that you do have a special debt of gratitude to your parents. They gave you life, and the fact that you survived was based on several decisions that they made, which may not have been easy. The mother, you know, did not terminate the pregnancy. They didn't abandon you when you were born. So you owe a special debt to them. Now, again, if you live in a deterministic worldview, okay, the mother and father had no choice in the matter. It was just kind of a biological thing, and that was that. You have a special debt. So when he talks about the debt here, this is one of the consequences of the teaching on karma. So this is all about karma, and the basic duty that it's calling forth is the quality of heedfulness. You should be very careful about what you do, because it has consequences. Now most of us, when we hear that, we say, oh shit. All we can think about is all the bad stuff we did in the past. Whoops, it's going to come and get us. Which is why the Buddha is talking about generosity and gratitude here. Because without the teaching on karma, generosity and gratitude would have no meaning either. So these are the good things in life, and they have meaning because of the principle of karma. What's this? And so because the Buddha is teaching, this is the basic working hypothesis that leads to heedfulness. This is the foundation for moving on then to the Four Noble Truths. because what you're looking at, okay, what am I doing in the mind that's actually creating suffering? So you're taking the principle of karma and you're applying it inwardly to solving the issue of where they're suffering and what can be done about it. Finally, the ultimate level of right view is the right view when you've basically perfected all the factors of the path. And at that point, all you need to do is let go. You know, in which case, anything that arises is suffering, and that's what you let go of, which would include the path. So there are three levels of right view. There's the right view that basically talks about karma and rebirth. There's the right view that talks in terms of the Four Noble Truths, and then there's the karma. There's the right view that once the Four Noble Truths fully develop them, then everything just gets let go. So you've got three different duties depending on which level of the practice you're at. The duty with regard to mundane right view, as I said earlier, is heedfulness. The duties with regard to the Four Noble Truths are those four duties we talked about earlier. Abandoning, comprehending stress, abandoning the cause, realizing the cessation, and developing the path. And then once the path is fully developed, then everything gets let go. Now, when the Buddha was teaching, he tried to get a sense of where you were in your practice, and which level of right view he was going to teach you. And if he saw that you were kind of on the lower level of practice, but you could be pulled up, he gave what was called a graduated discourse, where he'd first talk about the principle of karma, and then based on that, he'd talk about generosity. But how good it is to be generous. Then you talk about virtue, how good it is to be virtuous. You talk about the rewards that would come from these things, both in this lifetime and in future lifetimes. And then you would talk about the drawbacks of even those rewards. You get to go to heaven, you live in a heaven where there's nothing but pleasure. Then you fall. And when you fall, it's not a pleasant experience. I know a couple of people in Thailand who are extremely difficult people. They're always constantly demanding this and demanding that. Never satisfied. And my teacher's comment about this one woman, this one person in particular, was that she was a deva in the last lifetime. And when she fell hard. So those are some of the drawbacks. And then when you see the drawbacks of that kind of pleasure, then you see the value of renunciation. That would be good to go beyond that. And once you'd seen that, that's when he teaches the Four Noble Truths. Any questions on right view?
Could you please repeat the four duties again?
Okay. Comprehending stress. And that means understanding it to the point where you develop dispassion for it. And then for the cause, you abandon the cause. You stop doing it. For the third noble truth, you try to realize it. In other words, you try to observe it actually happening. And then the fourth noble truth is something you develop. A story John Fuhren told about one time when he was a young monk. And he had developed these really bad chronic headaches. He had tried Chinese medicine, Thai medicine, Western medicine, nothing worked. And it was getting so that he actually had to have people staying in his room with him at night when he'd wake up. And he'd wake up in pain. And there was one night he woke up in pain. And he'd look around and all the other monks who were looking after him were asleep. The first thought that went through his mind was, who's looking after whom here? Second thought is, well, at least now that I'm up, I might as well meditate. So he meditated for a while, and he realized that he'd been trying to get rid of the pain, and he hadn't been trying to comprehend it. Oops, missed the first duty, the first noble truth. So he said, let's just sit here and just try to comprehend the pain. And that was, he said, that night was kind of a big turnaround in his practice. Because what we normally try to do is we try to abandon the suffering. It's like going into your house and there's smoke filling the house and you're trying to put out the smoke. As long as the fire is still burning, there's still going to be more smoke coming out. You can't put out smoke. You put out fires. Anything else? Yes.
Did the Buddha actually use the word stress? It seems like it's really overworked.
Well, he used the word dukkha. And I don't know how overworked that was. What's interesting about his teaching is that he's the only one I can see that actually focused on this as the big problem. And one of the reasons I use stress instead of suffering is because I know a lot of people say, I don't have any suffering in my life. They ask him, do you have stress? Oh yeah, lots of stress. Okay, that's what we're talking about.
I don't know. It seems like growing up I never heard that word. But it seems sometimes
everywhere
that it's used as an excuse for behavior that would be considered undesirable.
Right. Well, in this case, the Buddha said it ain't no excuse, okay? And as he's pointing out, if you're really stressed out, it's not things outside stressing you out, you're stressing yourself out. The third reason I like to use stress instead of suffering is that it's hard to romanticize stress. Any other questions on this Four Noble Truths? Or right view of general, yeah.
I think my mom talks about embracing your suffering or your stress. Would that fall into realizing and observing it as it happens? Because you have to embrace it before you can really follow it, instead of just rejecting it or suppressing it.
Okay, it's, I guess, using the term embracing in the sense of just that, is just allowing it to be there and trying to get to know it. I mean, I personally don't like the idea of embracing my suffering, but allowing it to happen and say, okay, I want to watch you, I really want to understand what's going on here. That would be the best way to interpret that. Now, and of course, in order to be able to sit with any stress or pain, you've got to develop strong powers of concentration, so you don't get sucked in. The other problem with embracing is that you start listening to the story and you get pulled into the story. And so you want to be a psychoanalyst. Okay. The suffering is there on the couch and you're listening to the talking. Okay, you listen, you empathize, but you don't fully believe what's being said. That's how you comprehend it.
And the suffering that you are kind of framing here is the clinging. You talk about two kinds of suffering.
Right.
How do you distinguish those experiential? I mean, if suffering is suffering, or stress is stress.
Pain is pain.
Sorry?
Yeah, the pain is the pain. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but John Mahabhu has a really good set of talks on dealing with physical pain or mental pain. In the case that he was dealing with, he was giving talks to this woman who was dying of cancer. And she had a lot of physical pain around us. And so he said, okay, just be there and said, learn how to see the pain as one thing, your awareness of the pain is something else. The body is something else. You've got three separate things here that you are glomming together. And you want to be able to sit there and look at the experience until you can ferret out which part is the body, which part is the pain, which part is the awareness. Now you learn to identify body sensations as being the four properties. So is it heavy? Then it's not pain, it's body. Is it warm? Is it cold? Is it moving? That's not body. That's not pain. Those are qualities of the body. That requires that you sort of parse out your experience very carefully. Okay, there's going
to be the stress that's related to the three perceptions, which is just, what do you do with that? I mean, it's still an experience of unpleasantness. Things are changing. There's dukkha.
Yeah, there's the unpleasant. Then the question is, to what extent does this unpleasantness weigh on my mind? Because there are lots of unpleasant things out there in the world that are not weighing on your mind at all right now. Now, part of it's because you're not even aware of them. And the other part is, okay, it's not important. And so you're really, you're saying, I'm giving importance to this particular, so let's say you're dealing with physical pain. I'm giving a lot of importance to this physical pain. And it may be because I think it's invading my body or it's invading my mind. And to what extent can I see, well, my mind is still actually something separate from the pain. It's not the pain that's invading me, I'm going out there and messing with the pain. I'm laying claim to it, this is my body, this pain has no right being in my body. It's occupying my space. There's a lot of my in there. And what you see is the amount of mental pain that comes is going to be coming and going. It's not constant. There's an up and a down. And you want to watch it, you really want to be in a position where you can watch it so that you can see when the pain goes up, what went with it, what came up with it. When the pain going down, what did you stop doing? This is why I stressed that point yesterday, that alertness is about looking at what you're doing. What did I do when the pain went up? What did I do when the pain went down? What mental activity was happening? That's how you start parsing these things out. Because the stress in the three characteristics, that's going to be there. If you've got a body, it's going to have pain. But there's the stress that comes when, in the John Mahaprabhu's term, you create a bridge into the mind through your clinging, through your perceptions. You place labels on the pain that bring it in. You fabricate direct thought evaluation that brings it in. Can you see yourself doing that? Can you just say, okay, every time I touch this, it gets hot. Why don't I just stop touching it? See what happens. Yes.
Will you please name those three characteristics of pain again?
Okay. Well, they talk about the three characteristics as things are inconstant, stressful, not self. And the most basic use of the concepts is if you see anything that's inconstant, you have to realize, okay, if I try to place my happiness on it, it's going to be stressful. Because it's constant, stressful, why would I want to cling to it? It's basically, these are perceptions that you apply to something so that you can let go of it.
In terms of the pain, you'd mentioned like a awareness that the pain is happening.
Those three things, okay, there's the awareness of the pain, there's the actual sensation of pain, and then there's the body, your sense of the body. And bodily sensations are different from pain sensations. It's a different order. Yes?
It seems like pain is a good example. When you, like the pizza example, where there would be a lot of noise going on in terms of, how am I going to support myself if I'm in pain all the time? Those kinds of things that can lead to the clinging and then to more pain because you're preoccupied with the unskillful thinking around it.
And one of the things, if you look at the perceptions you have around the pain, one of the big ones is, I have been in pain for this amount of time and I will be in pain for who knows how much longer. That's a painful perception.
Mm-hmm. It's not impermanent.
Yeah. You've got to say, look, the past pain is gone. I'm done with it. Future pain, I don't know how much long it's going to last. Mm-hmm. I do know I've got this pain right here, right now, and let's deal with that. Mm-hmm. And so you just let those other thoughts go. So you're right here. Mm-hmm. And that's when you can start seeing, okay, when does the level of pain drop, when does the level of pain go down? What did I do? What perception brought it up? What perception allowed it to go away? Mm-hmm. Let's just drop the perceptions that brought it up and stay with the perceptions that allow it to go away.
That takes a lot of concentration. Mm-hmm. And pain is a good way to learn concentration.
It's a good way to learn concentration. Also, it's a good motivation to stick with it. Mm-hmm. My teacher had a lot of students who would meditate with him. And one of the fun things about meditating with John Fuang was he was very quick on what was going on in people's minds. You know, you sit there and something would happen in your meditation. Is something happening in your meditation? And even if you're, if it's not you, you get to listen in. You know? And he wouldn't do that with his monks, but he did it with the lay people. And so there are a lot of people, it was kind of like, you know, entertainment for Friday night. Of course, if you're not really, if you're just there just for the entertainment, he'd drive you out, but it was entertaining. People would be having visions and all kinds of stuff. And after he died, a lot of the people who were meditating became less and less and less avid in their meditation, except for the people with chronic pain. All of the students I knew who had chronic pain, they were still serious meditators every time. So it's a good goad to keep you going. You know, it's a right view. Okay, let's break for lunch. And we'll be back here at 11, at 1:30.